Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. And by Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com.
Today on Maine Calling, notable court cases in Maine history. Carson versus Macon, Maine versus Thornton, Locke versus Karras. Unless you went to law school in Maine, there's a good chance you never heard of any of these cases. But they're among the most important rulings to come out of Maine, affecting public funding for religious schools, privacy and police searches, and mandatory union dues. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program we'll explore these and other notable cases in Maine's legal history at both the state and federal level, and we'll find out why they have had such an influence on precedent and policy. We'll also review some of the national cases currently being weighed by the U.S. Supreme Court that could have a profound effect on the rights and powers of the presidency. Maine Calling is coming right up. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're going to be talking about court cases in the news, but not just those making headlines of late. We'll also learn about some notable cases involving Maine over the years. My guests for the hour are Herb Adams. He's a journalist and adjunct professor of social science at Southern Maine Community College and a former state legislator. Also with us is Dimitri Baum, vice dean, provost, and professor of law at the University of Maine School of Law. We invite you to join the conversation. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll come to some of the cases on our docket today in a moment, but first, Herb Adams, why is this a subject that you've been exploring of late? This is a subject that you teach, and we were talking before air that it's your effort to get students to understand a specific important idea.
Well, certainly, in the world we live in, court decisions mean more and more all the time, whether or not we pay attention to them. You know, it's the most advanced in terms of having been online and all of that, of any of the three branches of government. But it's the one branch of government that you want the least to do with. If you get involved in it, you want to get out of it. And usually you probably wouldn't pay much attention to it. However, so much of our lives are governed by what is decided in these courtrooms by learned scholars of the law. And sometimes the results to a civilian are really surprising. The choices of the cases that we've made to talk about, if we get the chance, I think would show that to our students.
So in choosing the cases that you thought were sort of notable and useful in your effort here, what were the criteria? Were they cases that sort of changed law or further defined it? How did you find them and filter them, I guess?
I actually tried to choose those that which would surprise a student or surprise almost all of us civilians that might have a startling conclusion that had more effect on your daily life than you ever thought and rose to the important level from a state like Maine that it raised national constitutional questions, and it was taken by the United States Supreme Court. It would be important to remember that the United States Supreme Court picks and chooses the cases it wishes to hear. It may get, they may pick 60 a year, whereas the Maine State Supreme Court has to take every case appealed to it. So it is often that the main state Supreme Judicial Court will have 10 times the workload of the United States Supreme Court. And we don't always follow that because it's not part of our daily lives, perhaps until the blow falls. So all of a sudden, Maine, since World War II to about 1970, Maine didn't have a single case that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Since then, the door is wide open, and there have been major cases dealing with many amendments to the Constitution that have come from Maine and became of national importance.
Well, let's talk about, sorry to interrupt.
I think it's important that we learn those things.
Yes, excuse me. Let's talk about one of those. One is from 1984. A lot of these cases, as you point out, are relatively recent. Maine v. Thornton, which starts off in a rural field. It starts off as a marijuana arrest case and then emerges all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court as a case that is instructive on big issues, including, you know, privacy, search warrants, and surveillance. Tell us about that. Tell us about that case.
This is a good case to talk about because it really starts, as you said, in the backwood field in Maine and comes to national importance. 1984, it rises to what is the interpretation of the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution, the important prohibition of unreasonable search and seizure. But the facts are these. Acting on a tip, Hancock County police officers cut down a wooded path between the home of Mr. Thornton and his neighbor. And out back of Thornton's, they spotted a pot growing operation on Thornton's land. So they went back to the station, got a search warrant, got the pot, and got Thornton. And he sued about this, saying it was trespass and you did not have a legal search warrant. As it rose through the Maine system, the Maine Superior Court agreed with Thornton. The evidence was suppressed. Cops were trespassing, they said. And the Maine Supreme Judicial Court also agreed with Thornton. It was trespass, and so the evidence was going to be suppressed. The United States Supreme Court reversed it, rather surprisingly, 6-3. They said the evidence was legal. The cops were not trespassing because there was a doctrine called the Open Fields Doctrine, which was very broad in the way they interpreted it. It extended to all activities conducted out of doors, except in the immediate vicinity of your house. In other words, your home may be your castle, but your front lawn probably is not, or your front porch, if it can be seen by people making casual observation. Now, when you think about it, that's very broad. There was a lot of action, amicus curiae, meaning people not involved in the case as a matter of fact, but filing interesting petitions, giving their opinion to the court about how the court should rule. The American Farm Bureau and the Civil Liberties Union took Thornton's part. But many, many police and law enforcement agencies argued against Thornton. And the Supreme Court reversed it. So 6-3, the evidence was legal. This meant for privacy and search and seizure and evidence and surveillance of never thought of in 1984 are legal in the age of satellites and Google Streets, the internet searches, heat-seeking image guns, license plate scanners, perhaps, and this is still being figured out, DNA and genome decoding, certainly your financial information and medical record transfers. What's yours? And where is it? And when is it yours? So to get off on a pot charge, Thornton just constricted what you can do in plain sight or not on your own property, except just immediately around your house.
It's interesting
how your castle, but the road and your driveway and possibly your front lawn is not.
Yeah. Dimitri Baum, I want to bring you in on this, this open fields doctrine. Is this something that comes up in in your class discussions? Is this a case that you would sometimes use?
Well, it's not a case that I teach in my class, but I guess what I would say, the broader point, kind of to echo something Herb said, you know, the power of the court, the kind of authority that they have, right? We're talking about interpreting words like reasonable, right? Search. You know, when I teach the First Amendment class, we talked about interpreting what is speech, what is a restriction, right? So the court has quite a bit of power because they're interpreting very broad, open-ended language in the Constitution. And they have the final say as to what those words mean, right? And so, you know, when the framers were debating the structure of the government, there were some opponents of the setup of our judiciary. And the concern was that there is no check on the court, right? You know, other elected branches, you can vote them out of office if you don't like what they're doing. With judges serving for life, there's very little accountability. So whether it's the Fourth Amendment or First Amendment or the debate about abortion rights in the 14th Amendment, what does due process mean? Does it apply to abortion or contraceptives? Right. Those are all such kind of open-ended, high-level questions where you have judges serving for life at the federal level, making those decisions and oftentimes making policy judgments. You know, there's not a kind of a clear answer whether an open field, a search of an open field is or is not a search. And oftentimes there's no evidence as to what the framers actually thought about those things.
Yeah. And we will get to later in the program, I hope to get to how judges are chosen and that whole thing. But I want to continue on with case number two, which is Alden v. Maine, 1999. And this is about this begins with a group of probation officers who sue the state of Maine, their employer, alleging that the state violated overtime provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act. Herb, can you just talk about this case and why it's significant?
That case actually stood on one leg, at least, of the National Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, passed during the New Deal days. So it reaches back, and because it reached back to that, it reaches far into the future for us. It was decided in 1999, very, very high profile. 11th Amendment, would protect the states from lawsuits by their own citizens unless permission was given for the citizen to sue the state. The facts were these. He was a Maine probation officer. He sued Maine, as you pointed out, for overtime, saying that under the National Fair Labor Standards Act, he deserved better overtime pay. While his case was in mid-flight, the U.S. Supreme Court decided a different case, Seminole Indian Tribe versus Florida, 1996, that lawsuits versus the state by their citizens were barred by the 11th Amendment. So Alden switched to the state court system and worked its way up through our state system back to the United States Supreme Court. Now, Alden was argued, and the U.S. Supreme Court went 5-4 during the meantime for the Seminole decision versus Alden. Chief Justice Rehnquist himself ruled that states had immunity from private suits in the state's own courts, and it went beyond the power of Congress to change that by law alone. So you got to change the Constitution itself before you can sue the states. So it was big stuff. Otherwise, citizens could sue the state all the time. Citizens of Maine or any state could sue their own state all the time for their own grievances. Now, as it is, one has to get permission to sue the state. And when I was a legislator, we got several bills every session to pass a law specifically allowing by name a specific citizen of Maine to sue the state of Maine. And rarely do they ever pass. You know, caution and the U.S. Constitution stand in the way. And so Alden v. Maine helped erect one of those barriers.
Yeah. Dimitri Baum, I'm a novice about this, about the law and the history. But it seems to me that 1999 is fairly recent for this issue of sovereign immunity of the states to be, you know, decided at that level. Am I Do I have a right to be surprised by that?
You know, it's. I think Herb mentioned earlier that the court only hears, pretty a limited number of cases. You know, these days about 75, 70, 80 cases a year. So, you know, every year there are some really foundational, fundamental cases that come to the court that you would think, you know, in this nation's history, we would have decided what's the scope of certain powers or how does the First Amendment apply. But quite often we get really kind of groundbreaking, fundamental cases that decide really important issues. And, you know, the interesting thing about the 11th Amendment, of course, you know, the 11th Amendment has been around for a long time, but the first few words of it are talking about the judicial power of the United States. And so I think if you read the text, it does look like it's talking about the power of the federal courts, which is why a lot of people thought or assumed that you could go to state court and sue the state. And so the court didn't give the 11th Amendment the most textual of readings, but relied more on history. So a lot of times you have kind of really foundational issues that come up because people assume that, you know, a certain right exists or a certain power exists in judiciary. And so those issues become, only arise at a certain time. And of course, change in the nature of the court, in the membership of the court, sometimes it leads to kind of a groundswell of momentum, right? And so there's issues like the Second Amendment, right? You know, we have a long, long history of almost no litigation and silence by the court on the Second Amendment. And all of a sudden, based on the change in the membership of the court, it's become a hot issue. And now almost every year, we have really important foundational cases, including this year. We have a big Second Amendment case. And yet this is an amendment just sat there almost unlitigated for hundreds of years.
It's really interesting. I want to go to a third case, which is, Herb, correct me if I pronounce this, Altria Corporation v. Good.
I believe it's Altria, yes.
2009.
So it actually pronounced.
Okay, 2009, anyway, so it's fairly recent. And this is another divided Supreme Court ruling that is significant in the age of major industry lawsuits. Can you give us a brief on that and talk about why it's important?
Sure. Altria, if that's how it's pronounced, V. Good. Now, Good, I can pronounce. That was Stephanie Good. And she brought a lawsuit saying that state consumer laws, the main state consumer laws, could be used to sue big tobacco about misleading advertising claims. In this case, that the idea that, quote, light and, quote, low tar cigarettes was somehow, quote, safer. Now, you can well imagine how Big Tobacco, however you pronounce their name, came down hot on that one for the court. And the fact that it was a 5-4 decision, and when you look at the justices involved on either side, you can see this was a major arm wrestle. It came out that, yes, state consumer protection laws could be used to sue large corporations. This consumer protection law had to do with misleading advertising claims. Now, you can imagine very quickly how the ideas about that would expand to any grievance that a citizen felt about a misleading advertising. It was a major defeat for Big Tobacco, and it came from Maine, a non-tobacco growing state. So it was considered amazing. Now, having violated Maine's Unfair Trade Practices Act, many other people might think about how they might approach this and apply it to their own case in life. But all the five yes votes on the Supreme Court are gone now from the court. Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, Breyer, Kennedy. And the four no votes, of the four no votes, three are still on the court. Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, meaning that they ruled against Maine and for Big Tobacco. Now, those three are the core of a conservative court to this day. So this was a case that had major implications and may echo on into the future.
Yeah. Dimitri Baum, is this one of those cases that you were talking about earlier that that has a... So it just comes along and has a major impact?
Yeah, I mean, and the case is really about the preemption doctrine, right? So there's often, conflict that might exist between federal law and state law, and sometimes there's not a direct conflict, but there's a lot of federal regulation of a field, and the question becomes, can states act at all, or has the federal government basically preempted the entire field? And so, as you can imagine, there's quite a bit of federal regulation of tobacco, and so this is an issue that comes up. In lots of areas of the law, right? We're talking about healthcare or privacy or education, the areas that have historically been within state control, but now that you have quite a bit of federal regulation, you often have to ask this question of, has the federal government basically occupied the entire field to the point where states can't act, right? And so cases like this set a really important precedent. And obviously there's a lot of other cases on preemption where you try to figure out how much of a regulation at the federal level takes the issue entirely out of the hands of the state.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you. The number is 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. We're discussing some well-known and not so well-known court cases through the years that involve the state of Maine in some way. My guests are Dimitri Baum, Vice Dean, Provost, and Professor of Law at the University of Maine School of Law, and Herb Adams, Journalist, Adjunct Professor of Social Science at Southern Maine Community College, and a former state legislator. Join the conversation. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org, or comment on Facebook or Instagram, or just give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. We may get time to go back and talk about some of the older cases of interest, but let's bring it to the present. There are a number of, as we all know, cases now at the national level involving the former president that are making headlines each and every day. The one going on right now is this, the so-called hush money case. What I'm interested in this one is the news this morning that the judge in the case has ruled that the former president violated a gag order, has violated a gag order 9 times, and fined him $9,000, which obviously is not a lot of money for him. Dimitri Baum, I wanted to ask you about this, the gag order in general. In this case, the judge has directed Mr. Trump to not make public comments about jurors or court staff, or and his attorneys have said, well, wait a minute, that violates their client's right to free speech. Is there a tension there? Or is this something that's sort of being played out and tested in a way that it hasn't before?
Yeah, I mean, so judges have quite a bit of authority and power to control the proceedings in the courtroom, and there are certain effects that happen when you discuss the proceedings, right? So there's quite a bit of regulations of what, for example, prosecutors can say and discuss about their case. So, certainly can imagine a potential conflict with freedom of speech and this kind of regulation. But of course, freedom of speech is not absolute, right? There's a lot of exceptions to the kinds of things that you can say. And one of the historically accepted exceptions is kind of relates to the conduct of an ongoing trial and the way that it can prejudge or prejudice that proceeding, right? And so there's a lot of restriction on what lawyers and litigants can say during an ongoing trial. And generally those kinds of regulations that relate to a particular proceeding have been upheld as essentially an exception to the First Amendment.
And the politics obviously are at play here, where you could speculate as to whether Mr. Trump is trying to be arrested. The judge has said if you violate this again, he will put him in jail. I don't think we need to discuss that necessarily, but Dimitri, again to you. Are we in the midst? We've seen so many of these, the coverage of these headlines of these court cases. Can you recall a time where the courts were on the front page every day for so long?
Well, I think kind of going back to where we started, I think people are coming to recognize the power of the judiciary, right? And so even thinking back to the last few years, the debates about the selection of Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh and the abortion debate, right? So there's been a lot of big cases. I just think because every issue now ultimately reaches the court, and I think ultimately reaches the U.S. Supreme Court, we're seeing it more and more in the headlines. And of course, we have, a really an unprecedented scenario of the number of cases against a former president and against a kind of a leader of one of the two major parties in the United States. So I think it's become much more magnified, I think, in the public eye than it has historically been.
Yeah,
You
her,
know,
but yeah, go ahead, sir.
yeah, I might point out here, Keith, if I may, that when the debates on the foundation of the Republic were being made in the Constitutional Convention, Alexander Hamilton said that the judiciary would be the, quote, least dangerous branch, unquote, of the entire government of the United States. Certainly just the opposite today. If people were to think about it, I think they would conclude quite differently than did Alexander Hamilton.
I like how he put that, least dangerous. Let's talk a little bit about that then. When I was growing up, the Supreme Court, there was almost a reverence for it as a body, for the members. It was trusted. It was sort of like if all else failed, there was always the Supreme Court. Herb, do you, how would you describe how different that is today, and when do you think the change began?
Certainly, I think your point is right, Keith. When you studied the setup of the American government, you could chant the phrase, executive, legislative, judicial, and the judicial sat on a kind of a different cloud up there, separate from the rest of them. There were major bad turns the court took. Plessy versus Ferguson that said segregation was legal. And that was the court presided over by a Mainer, Chief Justice Melville Weston Fuller. Or, of course, the infamous Dred Scott decision, which took a war, the Civil War, to overturn. I would say that culture wars about it may have started to focus on things that you and I would not remember. That would be Brown versus Board of Education. Whereas the Supreme Court unanimously overturned a separate but equal Plessy versus Ferguson 50 years after. And that ginned up, shall we say, a certain kind of politics that I have now become very much in front of our politics today. Usually, when the case was decided, it was decided. And you set down that and went on with your life. Now it looks like there are those, perhaps more conservative bent, who thinks all of that was just a skirmish, and now comes the real war. And if we got the troops, you're going to lose. That was not ever thought of in the establishment of the Supreme Court of the United States, and certainly not in the foundation of the courts of Maine in 1819 and 1820. So far in Maine, we've avoided, I think, that kind of sword's point idea of argument. I am hoping our politics are such that we'll continue to avoid it, because our court is a very busy court and it affects every one of our lives. And the more you inject that other kind of thinking into it, you never feel like any problem is solved or any answer is final.
There's also Dmitry Baum, a has been a, I guess, a tacit understanding or belief that even those members of the Supreme Court who are considered to be conservative, that they would surprise us sometimes by the decisions they made that were based purely on, precedent or interpretation of the law. So you got a sense that, well, they might be conservative human beings, but their approach to deciding legal matters is sort of hard to guess. I guess what I'm getting at here is there more of a sense now that people's sort of personal political leanings may affect their rulings, or at least is that the public perception?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a time when we could sort of say ideology maybe plays less of a role. Maybe it actually did play a role, but we had examples like Justice Souter and maybe even Justice O'Connor and Kennedy, with certainly Justice Stevens. You have Republican-appointed Supreme Court justices who maybe even leaned to the left, right? I think these days we don't have that, right? So we have a kind of very clear divide. The Republican appointees vote one way in the most controversial cases. Democratic appointees vote another way. And you have kind of a battle over every appointment because it's such an important vote, right? Every vote makes such a big difference. And so we see that ideology and their politics seems to correlate very closely to their decision-making. And so I think the public perceives that, right? When you have a debate about, you know, how would you vote on a certain case, on Roe v. Wade or on some other issue? And then the court comes out and, you know, the six Republican appointees are in a block and the three Democratic appointees are in a block. And so I think this kind of pretense that judging is something separate from politics, that it's entirely independent of ideology or political philosophy, I think it's hard to really kind of buy that today when you're seeing the kind of political wrangling that goes on with the Supreme Court.
We've all seen how the Supreme Court justices are chosen. We've watched it live now over these past few decades. But I think it's interesting to talk about how judges at other levels, particularly the state level, are chosen in other states. And it might be a surprise to those of us who have been used to one system, but it is the case that in some states, judges are elected by the public and are elected in a partisan way. In other words, they run as a Democrat or as a Republican and are chosen that way. Some are elected but in a nonpartisan way, so their name's on the ballot, but not their political affiliation. And then there are other states that give various authority to legislators and to the governor, for example. To either of you, that would seem to be able to be really a setup for creating very different kinds of people on the bench with different motivations.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, I think here in Maine, we forget sometimes that there is a different way to select judges, because we see the federal system where we have an appointment of the president, and we see the Maine system where it's appointed by the governor that looks very, very similar, and we assume that's the norm. But as you mentioned, Keith, you know, in most of the states, judges face the voters, right? Either to get their job at the outset, they run for office, or sometimes they're appointed for a very short term and then run in an up or down retention election, whether they should keep their job. And yeah, I think that does create some different incentives, right? So when you have, live tenure and you're appointed by the governor, you might be thinking about, one set of people you might be accountable to. But when you have to face the voters, you have to run for office, you might have different things in mind, right? And so, in terms of accountability, you might be more accountable to people. In terms of independence, you might be less independent, right? You might be worried about what will keep you your job, right? Would you be voted out because you voted for something that's unpopular with the people? So there are pros and cons to every system, but I think it's important to recognize the dynamics that different selection methods could lead to.
Yeah,
it's true, and I think Dimitri makes an excellent point. The books for which I teach point out that at least 85% of all judges in the United States are elected. That is all the way from traffic judge to the Supreme Court of your state. Now, you have to think about that. There's no public financing for that. They're lawyers and running to be a judge. Now, who are the people that are going to fund your campaign? Fellow lawyers, who you're going to have to face before the courts that you might be elected to preside over at all levels. Textbooks I use, I have lots of pictures from around the country of very angry looking people standing in front of courthouses, holding up signs saying no activist judges, or a judge's picture with a bullseye drawn on it. or the international no symbol slashing through it. I have pictures in textbooks of not this state, let us say to the south of us, where billboards will be erected along the highways, showing the picture of a judge who took a unpopular position to some group, with a big sign saying, "You're next," on it. Now, if you're looking for impartial justice under the law, that sort of moves you to the place where whoever shouts the loudest is making the law. Maine is very lucky to avoid all of that. And we have never experienced that in our system, cross fingers, thus far.
I have, there's a listener who asks, how many members are on the Maine Supreme Court and their political affiliation, if known? I'm sure we can get the number. Not sure that political affiliation is listed, and it's assumed. I don't know. I'll let either of you, Dimitri. Do you want to comment?
Well, I think Herb's the expert in the state. I think there's seven justices. Well, I believe there's a vacancy right now. In terms of the affiliation, they're in theory apolitical in a sense that they don't run for office. They don't have a political party affiliation. They're obviously appointed by the governor. I think Herb might have the count of who all the appointments were by. I don't know if Herb, you have that.
I don't know that off the top of my head, but your point is correct. They sometimes reflect the philosophy of the governor, more likely, say, at the district court level, where you can appoint one every 7 years, because there is a term limit for judges there, 7 years. And Governor LePage appointed very different kind of people than Governor Mills has, who incidentally was one of the very first graduates of the UMaine Law School. So she knows of what she speaks. And the Chief Justice of the Maine Court currently is a woman. And it's unusual in that she succeeded a woman, Lee Softly. Now, of course, you know her very well, Dimitri. She's the Dean of the school there. She was in the first UMaine law class that was more than 50% women. So just between two of these important officials, you can see how times have changed. And the judicial philosophy they may bring to the bench has been, I'd say, pretty balanced overall in Maine. You as a professional might have a different thought on that. But as far as me trying to make sense of it for students and the public, I'd say it's been fairly balanced.
Yeah. We'll talk more about this in a moment. We're going to take a quick break. The number to join the conversation is 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Our topic today is the law, in particular, interesting Maine court cases over the years and court cases on the front page of the morning newspaper. My guests are Dimitri Baum, Vice Dean, Provost, and Professor of Law at the University of Maine School of Law, and Herb Adams, a journalist, former state legislator, and adjunct professor of social science at Southern Maine Community College. Share your questions and comments. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, the number 1-800-399-3566. You were talking before the break about the changing face of the Maine Supreme Court. And of course, diversity has been a major theme and a major push in workplaces across America in recent years. Dimitri Baum, has that extended into the court system? Are we seeing appointments and to the bench of people who better reflect, you think, the people they serve?
Yeah, absolutely. I think diversity has been an important point for the judiciary generally, right? And if we're looking at the Supreme Court, obviously we have the first African-American woman on the court. And so we have, more racial diversity on the U.S. Supreme Court. There are some concerns, however, right? Many of the justices have a very similar background, right? So, historically, if you look at the court, we've had people who served in office, right, and understood the politics and how things played out on the ground. that's becoming less and less common for kind of elected officials to go to the Supreme Court. There's a lot fewer Westerners, right? And just as Gorsuch, of course, is from Colorado. But we're kind of seeing a lot of the similar pathway to the Supreme Court, you know, folks going through Harvard and Yale as, you know, a couple of law schools, more of the East Coast connections working through the federal government and going to the Supreme Court. And that does raise some concerns, right? So there is some, I think, advantage to having somebody who's been a trial judge around the country and understands how trial judges would read the decisions. Somebody who served in office and understands how legislators might read decisions or how legislators work. Right. So I think diversity is really important, but I think we should think about more than just racial diversity, but different kinds of experiences that people can bring to the court and why that's really valuable when you're deciding, you know, really high level abstract questions like what is reasonable.
Yeah. So diversity can mean a diversity of experience as well.
As well as racial, ethnic, gender diversity, but really thinking writ large about the kinds of experiences you want represented in the court. And I think in that way, the court, while it's become more racially diverse, it has not become more diverse. It becomes less diverse in terms of background of the justice experiences.
We can't get away today without talking about another case in Washington, which the federal election interference case involving the former president, which has now become now known as the immunity case because the president, of course, claiming immunity. And we saw recently the arguments in that case. I'm sure both of you saw it. And it appears that to the extent to which you can read the mind of Supreme Court justices, but even among the conservatives, there appears to be some doubt about the idea that a president has, you know, complete immunity for acts carried out as president. Herb, what's your take on? I'm not sure. I don't know if you saw it or not, but would that characterize how you saw it?
Yes, Keith, I think that was well said. Of course, here in Maine, as we look at that case, which I'm surprised that the U.S. Supreme Court took at all, you kind of feel like you're watching an artillery duel above your head. Whatever happens is going to fall on us eventually. And that is, you can read the debates of the Constitutional Convention, the thought that anybody would act that way, that required further definition in the document they rolled out the door in 1787. That thought never occurred to them. Likewise, they imported the British idea of impeachment, which went without use, of course, for almost 100 years until after the Civil War. I believe it goes back to a point that Dimitri made earlier about the extraordinary division of politics. It used to be that war was the continuation of politics by another means. Now, suing in court is the continuation of war by other means. And that, I'm sure that they never anticipated back then. And Maine was very fortunate to have avoided for so long. If I may also pointing out about what Dimitri said about different backgrounds, for example, one of the very first Francos to be appointed to the Maine Supreme Court was Judge Armand Dufresne, who came up the hard way in Aroostook County. He never went to law school. He read law like Abraham Lincoln did from a learned colleague, his senior, and went to the Supreme Court of Maine, Supreme Judicial Court of Maine, and was an outstanding, much beloved and highly respected judge whose decisions stand the test of time. They're common sense. They are written by a real person for real people, really reading the best intent into the law. So we've been lucky here, and I am shocked, really, that the U.S. Supreme Court even would touch the dynamite of this absolute immunity case. They did. In fact, they hugged the dynamite right to their chest. But we don't know by how many votes, because they take these votes in conference. They usually will never reveal who decided and how they voted. And we'll have to wait for the memoirs of members of this Supreme Court 30 years from now to find out some of the background on it and the reasoning that's going to go into whatever they come up with very soon.
Dimitri, the justices themselves said basically agreed that yes, this is a decision for the ages. I mean, this is a case where as we had said, you know, it's never really been tested to any real degree in the past, and so this would have huge implications, right?
Yeah, and really trying to understand what the kind of lack of history means here, right? So I think one side says, well, presidents have never been prosecuted, and therefore it was understood that they are immune, that they wouldn't be prosecuted. And the other side says, well, no, just haven't prosecuted because they knew they should engage in criminal conduct. And when they do engage in criminal conduct, they can't be prosecuted. There is a little bit of precedent here. And the classic case is the Fitzgerald case. This is President Richard Nixon firing somebody. And at least the court in that case said, you're immune from civil liability from your official actions, right? So the idea is that if you take an official presidential action, you shouldn't always be looking over your shoulder as a president that someone's going to sue you for employment discrimination or for some other kind of legal theory that might apply. Now, this was a civil case. And so I think one of the big questions here is, does it apply to criminal actions? And if so, what kinds of criminal actions, right? And none of these things have an easy answer. You know, deciding, even if we agree that some official actions are immune, what does it mean to say it's an official action, right? Is approving an alternative slate of electors that you know are fraudulent, is that an official action or not? And what kind of knowledge do you have to have? Or is this a threat of litigation? Is that enough to deter presidential action? So we should even inquire into your state of mind. You just look at, are you acting as president or not? Right, so the court doesn't have a ton of guidance or precedent here. And as Herb mentioned, not a lot of founders era history as well. They didn't discuss these kinds of details about presidential immunity. There's nothing in the text of the Constitution that talks about presidential immunity. So you're drawing out kind of broad rules and principles out of structure, out of policy, but there's nothing concrete to grab onto for a principle here.
And the bookend to that, Dimitri, is the excellent statement from John Adams, who was not writer, not an author of the Constitution, not a framer, but an observer of all those things, who said, "We are a government of laws and not of men, period." Now, today we'd say not of people, of course, including all humans, but that's the fundament of it. And I don't know how this Supreme Court wrestles with any of that, to tell you the truth. We will see.
And I'm curious, we have about a minute left, but does the court just simply answer the question about the case of Mr. Trump in these circumstances, or will they venture out and to clarify all the questions that you raised, Dimitri, about the people are wondering about for future application?
The court can write its opinion in the way that it feels appropriate. So it can really narrow the opinion to focus on a particular case, or it can write a broad opinion to address issue of absolute immunity or qualified immunity in the future cases as well. Now, of course, because they only hear 75 to 80 cases, writing a broader opinion does give lower courts more guidance in future decisions, but also it's not exactly the case in front of them. So you might not have all of the facts fleshed out for those kind of hypothetical future cases. So the court always starts to strike a balance between deciding the case in front of them and giving some guidance to lower courts to apply that precedent to new scenarios.
Well, it's a way that I hate to end shows by saying, well, we'll see what happens, but I have no choice in this case. Thank you both for an interesting conversation this hour. Appreciate it. Herb Adams
Thank
is...
you.
A journalist, a former state legislator, and an adjunct professor of social science at Southern Maine Community College, and Dimitri Baum is vice dean, provost, and professor of law at the University of Maine School of Law. Today's sound engineer was George Thomas. Maine Calling's produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. Visit the Maine Calling website to sign up for our weekly newsletter, and at our website you can also listen back to any of our previous programs. For those of you who are looking to make a comment about an upcoming show or share an idea, check out Maine Public's new smartphone app called the Maine Public Vox Pop. And once you download it, you can have a quick and easy way to share a voice message with the Maine Calling team. That's Maine Public Vox Pop, V-O-X-P-O-P. Tomorrow on the program, we listen back to parts of some recent shows that we think deserved a re-airing. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall.